Session is called to order. Could the bailiff please bring in the witness? Good morning, ma'am. Good morning. We hope that you have recovered from yesterday's ordeal. It's a bit fresher today. Without any further ado, I'll give the floor to the prosecutor to continue with the examination of the witness.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, when we left off yesterday, I believe we were wrapping up the year 1991. And I guess just before we move on to 1992, is there anything that you could tell us, I guess briefly, that would basically recap the theme or basically what was occurring in 1991?
The attack of the RPF had raised the possibility of an eventual alliance or collaboration between the dissident political movements developing in the country with the RPF. This had been a concern of the government very early on, and had, I believe, been one of the motives behind the arrests which were so immediate. I think it was, they were intended as a warning to people not to consider working together with the RPF. Nonetheless, the internal political dissidents, a number of them began to move in the direction of an informal alliance with the RPF. And this provoked a reaction of serious concern on the part of Habyarimana and his supporters. And I would like to, in that connection, read from my notes a quote taken from a letter addressed by the prefect to President Habyarimana in 1991, in which they advised him to vigorously, this is quote, to vigorously destroy the maneuvers of the enemy, both the Inyenzi terrorists and those of the opposition that has developed inside the country, end quote. They went on to say also, and again I quote, that he should fight openly against what could be called the Kanyarengwe effect, which poses a serious threat to the necessary solidarity of the Bahutu, end quote. The Kanyarengwe effect refers to Colonel Alexis Kanyarengwe, who was a major Hutu opponent of President Habyarimana and who had left the country and then joined the RPF and was serving as its president or chairman. The reference here is clear. Other Hutu dissidents must be prevented from joining the, quote, Inyenzi terrorists. That same theme reappears again in the military press releases, which we mentioned yesterday. That came at the end of December 1991, where again, after a more or less cursory nod in the direction of acceptance of political multi-partyism, the military cautioned against those members of the internal political opposition who might choose to work together with the RPF. That communique, which was broadcast, as I mentioned yesterday, on the national radio at the insistence of President Habyarimana, was also circulated through the Ministry of Interior to the prefects, who were directed to make wide use of it in popular meetings. So it is clear that the concern existed on the part of Habyarimana and those close to him, and that they were anxious to counter what they saw as a threat of possible union between the internal political opposition and the RPF by beginning a preemptive action themselves to depict anyone who chose such an alliance as a traitor to the country.
Let's move to March of 1992. My first question is, do you know of a place in Rwanda known as Bugesera?
Bugesera is a geographical term that refers generally to the area south of Kigali, just about directly south of Kigali, close to the Burundi border.
Okay. As part of your, your commission, the International Commission Investigating Human Rights Violation, did you investigate some events which took place there?
We did. We investigated a massacre of Tutsi in the region generally known as Bugesera, particularly in the commune of Kanzenze, which took place in early March 1992.
Briefly describe to us what happened at this location at that time.
The Bugesera massacre, like the earlier massacres of Tutsi, was touched off by a false alert by the use of the radio to broadcast five times in one day a warning, supposedly from a human rights organization based in Nairobi, which in fact did not exist, a warning that the Tutsi of Bugesera were preparing to kill a significant number of Hutu in that region, particularly some Hutu political leaders. In the week or 10 days before the radio broadcast, Hassan Ngezi had also been active in that region. Hassan Ngezi is a journalist and propagandist in the service of the Habyarimana government. He was in the area of Bugesera circulating a tract, again warning about the attack by Tutsi. This tract is reprinted, I believe, in the International Commission report, which is at the disposition of the court as one of the exhibits. Following the preparation of the population by the tract and then by these repeated radio announcements, attacks were launched by the Hutu population under the direction, of local authorities on Tutsi in the region. Again, the killing went on for 3 days. And the number of victims was between 300 and 400. The massacre was notable also, in addition to being the first use of the radio, it was notable also in that it was the first use of party militia to attack Tutsi.
So before we move forward, how are you able to say that, first of all, it was a false alert? I mean, how do we know that?
The organization which purported to have produced the press release that the radio broadcast was non-existent. We investigated that, and such an organization apparently never existed. In addition, we did a cursory examination of the font face of the typewriter used to produce the tract which circulated in the area. And although we were not experts, it appeared to us to be the same as the font face of the typewriter in the Bureau Communal.
Now, you mentioned the use of the radio, and that this was the first time that the radio was used. Before we talk about this in further detail, are you familiar with basically radio in general in Rwanda, meaning if people listen to it widely and as a source of communication or receiving information?
The radio was an enormously important source of information. It was regarded as the voice of the government. It was directly responsible to President Habyarimana himself. It regularly broadcast official announcements, such as, for example, the appointment of people to government office, the prefect of Kibuye. Clement Kaishema told me that he learned of his appointment as prefect over the radio. The prefect of Butare, Sylvain Nsabimana, told me that his appointment was announced over the radio. The announcement, for example, of candidates who had been accepted to public schools, various secondary public schools, was announced over the radio. It was ordinarily used to call officials to meetings. In addition, news broadcasts were frequently preceded by or followed by extracts of speeches by President Habyarimana, so that in the minds of listeners, there was no doubt that the radio was the voice of the government.
Now, in your work, did you ever collect transcripts of things that were broadcasted on the radio, either at this Bugesera event or other events?
Yes, I have collected tapes of broadcasts done on both Radio Rwanda and also on RTLM.
Now, you said that this was the first use of the radio in this fashion. I mean, explain this for us a bit, please.
Well, I'm not sure at what point the decision was made to move simply from print media to the use of the radio, but clearly, at least the director of the radio service, who was at that time Ferdinand Nahimana, had the idea that this was an effective way to reach the population. In the 1991 census in Rwanda, 29% of the households, I believe, are recorded as having owned a radio set. In fact, the extent of reach of the radio was far beyond 29%, because neighbors shared information from the radio. People who did not own radios regularly asked others what the news was. Radios played in boutiques, in stores, in bars, so that people were able to hear information from the radio in those contexts as well. The use of the radio in this case was so blatant and was that it was rather quickly known, in part because my Rwandan colleagues relayed the information about what was happening in Bugesera very quickly to the European diplomatic community, and even succeeded in persuading several representatives of embassies to go to Bugesera to witness what was happening. Following this, the extent of the reaction of the international community against the use of the radio in this fashion was so great that Habyarimana was obliged to remove Ferdinand Nahimana as the head of the radio.
Just another question on the radio. You basically told us that it was wide-reaching, using my words here. Did you see this in your own field work and experiences when you lived and stayed in Rwanda?
Yeah, indeed. As part of the work that I did on the democratization project that I mentioned previously, I traveled extensively in the communes, and one of the proposals that we were considering was funding an independent radio to be a kind of voice of the ordinary people in opposition to the official radio, to evaluate the usefulness of such a proposal. I ordinarily ask people whom I interviewed out on the hills whether or not they listened to the radio, how often they listened to the radio. I do not have a statistical analysis of the results of my questions, but certainly my strong impression at the time was that the radio was a major influential force in people's lives to such an extent that I did recommend that the U.S. government find a way to fund an independent radio.
You mentioned for us in this area of Bugesera that this was at least the first known use of militias, correct?
The first use of militia, clearly targeting Tutsi in large numbers, yes.
Can you please explain that for us in further detail?
In the course of the conflict that I described yesterday, the vigorous contests among political parties, these parties developed youth wings. This is a common organizational maneuver by political parties in many parts of the world. Each of the major organizations, the major parties that I described yesterday, had its youth wing. The MRND had a group called Inherahamwe. The MDR had a group called Inkuba Thunder, or sometimes called JDR, Jeunesse Démocratique Républicaine. The PL had its youth group, although it was not very large. And the PSD also had one, Abakombozi. The youth wings officially were meant simply to assist in recruiting members, in preparing party meetings. Sometimes they prepared music and dance to liven up the political meetings. But as the turf battles, the conflict for territory and members that I described yesterday became increasingly sharp, particularly between the MDR and the MRND, these young people were called into service for actual attacks. And if you recall yesterday, when I described the Kubohoza, going to people's houses, attacking them, taking their party insignia, taking their party cards, disrupting political meetings, these were the work done by the party militia, the party youth groups. Now, what distinguished the Inherahamwe from the other groups, and the CDR militia also, which we'll get to in a minute, what distinguished them from the other party youth groups was the formality of their military training, that they were actually trained to attack and to kill and to injure, and their access to weapons. The phenomenon of the youth groups was in fact general, but the Inherahamwe and the Mhuza Mugambi, which was the group attached to the CDR, were special in the extent of their military training. They were trained by soldiers and their access to weapons.
Well, on this issue with the Inherahamwe and the training, was this training actually taking place in 1992, or are we talking about a different time period?
The training has actually begun with small groups as early as 1992. The Procureur of Kigali told me that in 1992, for example, he saw Inherahamwe regularly wearing or equipped with what he described in French as cordelettes. Cordelettes apparently are a kind of rope which is used by military as a belt and which has a buckle on the end. And these are used to hit people. And they were a fairly specialized item of dress which belonged to the military. When he began to see Inherahamwe with these cordelettes, he understood the extent of their connection with the formal military service, because this was not the kind of item that you could buy in the marketplace. And he, at that point, attempted to begin an investigation, which in the end produced very little, about these connections.
How many people were actually killed based on your investigation at Bugesera?
In Bugesera, between 300 and 400, probably closer to 400.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the CDR. Please tell us what that is and when they first came into existence.
In the CDR, the Coalition for the Defense of the Republic, was a political party formed in the same month as the Bugesera massacre, in March of 92, by a group of hardline Hutu who believed that the MRND was not sufficiently extremist in its position. In the early months of 92, just before the Bugesera massacre, the political parties of the opposition had been growing in strength. And this was demonstrated particularly in January, when there was a massive street demonstration, far beyond anything that had been seen in Rwanda previously, organized by the opposition political parties to demand a share in government positions, a role in the cabinet. President Habyarimana was under extreme pressure because of this popular effervescence and demand for participation in government. And it was in that context that the CDR was formed. There were times when the CDR criticized the MRND and Habyarimana personally. At the time of its formation, its opening statement said very clearly, there is no other party on the political scene that is completely devoted to the interests of the majority, which was their code word for the interests of the Hutu, and therefore we have found it necessary to organize this new party. At various times from its formation on until 1994, the CDR was occasionally in opposition to Habyarimana, standing even further towards the end of the spectrum of Hutu extremism, but also frequently worked together with Habyarimana. And this was worked out on the ground by a collaboration between the CDR militia, the Imhuza Mugambi, and the MRND militia, the Inherahamwe.
Well, how do you know this? I mean, did you personally see this, or is this the result of your work?
This is a result of my interviews with victims, and the result of extensive conversations with other experts and with foreign diplomatic observers.
What was, basically, after the formation of the CDR, what was the state of multipartyism at this time in the area of March 1992 and April of 1992?
The pressure on Habyarimana to open up power at the ministerial level succeeded in April 1992 with the formation of the first real coalition government. There had been a nominally coalition government earlier, but that had involved only one member of the PDC, which was a very small and insignificant party, because the larger opposition parties had refused to accept the conditions that Habyarimana set for their participation. So April 92 was the first time when there was an effective coalition government leading the country, including members of those in opposition, members of parties in opposition to Habyarimana.
Well, this coalition government, how did it come about? Was it through some sort of electoral process or just strict appointment by party leaders or the president?
As we say in the American political idiom, horse trading. In other words, negotiations among the political party leaders themselves resulted in the creation of the coalition.
Once this coalition was created, what was the balance of power like at this time?
The coalition government represented a considerable lessening in the power of Habyarimana and gave the internal opposition political parties for the first time a real chance to influence national policy. From this point onward, the action of the national government becomes more complicated because the conflicts between Habyarimana and those opposed to Habyarimana played themselves out at the very highest level as well as further down the hierarchy, so that I will try to be careful and precise and from this point forward in my references. It's no longer appropriate to speak of the Rwandan government as a single entity from this time forward. It is instead a seriously divided organization, which often, where one part often acts against the wishes of the other, and where any positive movement forward is seriously hampered.
This, I guess, sharing of power, were we starting to see it at lower levels as well, meaning down in the prefectures and the commune?
It began at the top. Because the negotiations involved the people at the top, and they wanted to assure their own seat at the table first. But of course, they understood that the reality of power rested in control all down the administrative hierarchy. So not long after the initial negotiations obtained a place at the table for these other parties in April, in July, the MDR, the PSD, and the PL each succeeded in wresting a prefecture from the MRND. So from July on, there were also three prefectures headed by prefects of opposition parties. And following that, the next stage, and in many ways the more significant stage, was obtaining control at the communal level. Sorry.
Go ahead.
This did not happen so quickly or so easily. There had been an administrative evaluation committee established to review the performance of burgomasters. That was the device which was to make it possible, again through a process of negotiation among the parties themselves, to make it possible to introduce a diversity of opinion among the burgomasters. So the Administrative Commission eventually recommended the removal of approximately one-third of the burgomasters for a variety of reasons. Actually, a couple of them had resigned, been driven away essentially by Kubahosa. Some of them were removed for administrative incompetence. Some of them were removed for human rights violations.
Well, this, what you're talking about, do we see this happening in the summer of 1992,
or is this a later process? No, this is subsequent. This is later.
Okay. Well, in this period of the summer of 1992, you mentioned Kubahosa. Were we seeing this in 1992?
It's going forward very, very vigorously at this point. And there are a lot of shifts going on, not just as the result of calling out youth groups, armed youth groups, to use against opposition parties, but also reward, so that it's a very fluid political scene. And that fluidity itself stimulates a growing sense of insecurity.
Were we seeing this at the communal level?
Yes, that's where it all happens, basically. There were some changes happening as a result of the changes at the ministerial level. For example, ministers began replacing members of the bureaucracy in their ministry, replacing people who were MRND stalwarts with people who were members of their own parties. And this created a lot of resentment. But it was really at the communes that the struggle was going forward most vigorously in terms of trying to persuade the population to either leave the MRND and choose a new party affiliation, or to remain with the MRND.
Well, did your work reveal whether or not there were, I guess, as part of this Kubahosa, demonstrations at, for example, bureau communales and things like that?
There were frequently demonstrations at the national level, also demonstrations at the local level. For example, I'm just trying to be sure of the date here. There were several communes where local political organizations, for example, I'm thinking here the commune of Nyakizu, where the MDR forces were able to organize, and by a series of roadblocks and disruptions, and then eventually attacks on the burgomaster, forced the burgomaster, who was MRND, to leave. So that, yes, there were actions at communal offices as well as at other places.
You also mentioned that some prefectures were taken away from the MRND. Do you know whether or not Gitarama was one of those prefectures?
Gitarama was given to the MDR at this time, I believe.
What was the state of the, I guess, the conflict between the RPF and the, and I guess, the government of Rwanda at this time, in the July, June 1992?
Let's back up just a minute. When the parties of opposition entered into the coalition government, they also were engaged in discussions with the RPF itself. They met RPF representatives in Paris and were able to begin forcing the MRND part of the government, somewhat reluctantly, towards negotiations. There had been previous ceasefires and discussions about negotiations, but none of this had been taken very seriously. But once the coalition government existed and the forces of opposition had a place at the ministerial table, they were able to insist upon real negotiations with the RPF. These produced a ceasefire in July of 1992, and the first part of the Arusha Accords, in August of 1992. The Arusha Accords, let me indicate, involved a very long process of negotiation and a series of protocols that were signed over a period of 13 months. So August 92 was the first, but the final and definitive protocol was not signed until August of 93. But the ceasefire, there was a ceasefire in July of 92 and the first part of the Arusha Accords in August of 92. At the same time, immediately before the ceasefire, or in the several months before the ceasefire, the RPF had launched an aggressive thrust into northeastern Rwanda in the region of the, in the prefecture of Byumba, and had acquired a certain amount of territory. This was the first real formalization of a foothold for the RPF in Rwanda. The July 1992 ceasefire recognized this status and recognized their control over this territory. Subsequently, the role played by MDR, PL, and PSD in moving towards negotiations at this point was taken as a sign that they had betrayed the country and handed over a part of the national territory to the RPF. That was the attitude of Hutu hardliners, that these internal former opposition political parties, now part of the government, had in effect betrayed the country by pushing for negotiations, which had resulted in concession of a piece of territory to the RPF.
Well, let's talk about this, excuse me, July 92 ceasefire and the subsequent agreements that occurred in 92 in August. What I want to do now, with the Chamber's permission, is to show you Exhibits 73 and 73A. And again, for the Chamber and Council, these items are to be found in the binders, volume number 2. First, looking at Exhibit 73 itself, can you please tell us what that is?
This is the text of the ceasefire agreement, or the annex to it. Let's see. Yeah, from July 1992.
Can you please look at 73A and tell us what that is?
This is the French translation of the same thing.
Okay. I will be working from the English version, which is 73. And we'd like to go through this and look at a few passages. We will make reference to the French.
To Jasper on the floor.
I understand you said this is an agreement signed 92, but the copy I have here is signed in January 93. Are we speaking about the same document? No, it starts, as a matter of fact. No, I'm wrong, perhaps. It starts to say amended September 16 September 91 and 12 July 92, but then at the end says done at Arusha the 9th of January 93. I hope it's the same document we're speaking of.
Yes, in fact, Your Honor, maybe I can shed some light. It is the same document.
Okay, that's all I want to know. Sure. For typing. Thank you.
It starts in July, and then the subsequent pages are the August. And the last set of pages is the January 93 portion of this agreement and ceasefire.
Thank you.
Thank you. This first portion, I guess the first two pages of Exhibit 73, is this the ceasefire between the parties?
Yes, it is, between the RPF and the government of Rwanda.
I want to go to, on the English version, page 174, and I believe on the French version, it will be pages 17 and 18. My first question is, as part of this, this agreement of July, and I guess it spills into the August portion of the agreement, was there a focus on more than just the ceasefire, meaning going into rule of law issues?
Yes, I believe that those ideas were introduced very early, even in this agreement.
On page 174 and on page 18 of the French version, there's a section cited as Chapter 1, National Unity, Article 1. Can you please read Article 1 for us?
National unity must be based on equality of all citizens before the law, equal opportunities in all fields, including the economic field, and respect for fundamental rights as stipulated notably in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the African Charter on Human and People's Rights.
How about Article, could you slowly read also Article 2, 3, and 4?
National unity implies that the Rwandese people, as constituent elements of the Rwandese nation, are one and indivisible. It also implies the necessity to fight all obstacles to national unity, notably ethnicism, regionalism, integrism, and intolerance, which subordinate the national interest to ethnic, regional, religious, and personal interest. Article 3. National unity entails the rejection of all exclusions and any form of discrimination based notably on ethnicity, region, sex, and religion. It also entails that all citizens have equal opportunity of access to all the political, economic, and other advantages which access must be guaranteed by the state.
Okay. Thank you. Those were Articles 1 through 3. Now, looking at these articles, does it appear that the parties addressed and focused on the issue of, number one, ethnicity, and number two, I guess, the regional conflict that we have been seeing to date in Rwanda?
The language of a document like this is not surprising. This would be the kind of language one would expect in such formal agreements, but it's clear that it is understood by the participants to refer to the existing ethnic and regional conflicts which have troubled Rwanda.
Thank you. I want to jump to Article 7, actually. Now, it's on page 175 of the English and page 20 of the French. Can you please read Article 7 for us, please?
The two parties recognize that multipartyism entails legitimate existence of a democratic opposition, and consider as legitimate the aspiration of any Rwandese citizen to accede to power through democratic process.
And can you read Article 8 for us, please?
Article 8, the two parties resolutely reject and undertake to fight political ideologies based on ethnicity, region, religion, and intolerance, which subordinate national interest to the ethnic, regional, religious, or personal interest. Any form of coup d'etat as being contrary to the democratic system as described above.
Now again, do these two articles appear to address, the issues of the day at that time and what we have been discussing here?
They do.
Now I would like to turn to Article 15, which is on page 176 of the English. I just want to ask you about this. The second paragraph discusses the investigation work of a commission Could you please explain that for us, please?
As part of the recognition of the importance of breaking with impunity for past crimes, the signatories have agreed to the desirability of an international, of a national commission on human rights, and also to an investigation into human rights abuses. And the commission on human rights would have the right to not only educate people, but to actually institute legal proceedings. Oh, I'm sorry, am I reading? Yeah, that's what you wanted, right?
Yeah. Is this your commission?
Actually, no. We should be looking at Article 16 here.
Okay.
Article 16, which is the two parties also agree to establish an international commission of inquiry to investigate human rights violations committed during the war. It's clear that in the realm of international relations, human rights has become an increasingly important measuring stick for the legitimacy of a government. As a result, participants in an armed conflict or participants anxious to establish their credibility on the international scene often wish to appear as defenders of human rights. That may have formed the background to this article. But in addition, there was a strong pressure by Rwandan human rights organizations who were beginning to play a crucial role in the political scene. They were insisting upon an investigation into the massacres of Tutsi, which had taken place in the preceding months and years. There may also have been international pressure in this direction that I don't know about, but I do know that there was significant domestic pressure for a commission to investigate these massacres. There was a sense that only an international investigation could produce the truth about the possible involvement of the government in these massacres. Subsequently, the Rwandan Minister of Foreign Affairs, I believe, although it might possibly have been the Minister of Justice, approached Amnesty International and asked Amnesty to organize such an international commission of inquiry. Amnesty refused because they do not make investigations at the request of such a party. That idea, however, of an international commission was kept alive by the Rwandan human rights organizations. And later in the year, they approached Human Rights Watch and the International Federation of Human Rights based in Paris to ask us to organize such an international commission of inquiry, but as a non-governmental undertaking with no connection to the Rwandan government or any other. So here was the first mention of that idea. As it eventually took shape, it was somewhat different in conception from this, but it was, in fact, the origins, I believe, of the commission of which I was co-chair.
Thank you. One moment, please. Okay, I just have two more sections. Could you please flip to page 184, which will be Article 55, and on the French version, it is page 51. In looking at Article 55, does it appear that the parties discussed an issue of a broad-based transitional government?
The negotiations which had begun with the ceasefire produced the initial protocol in August, and then a subsequent protocol in October, which is reflected in this article here, agreeing upon the division of power in a transitional government that was to run the country in the period before elections.
In this particular article, does it break down, I guess, portfolios for each party?
It does. And what it reflects here is a kind of tripartite structure. The government, as it was created in April of 92, was a two-part structure. There was the Habsyayamana bloc, and there was the opposition bloc. But what emerges from the Arusha Accords and is described here is a three-part structure where you have the Habsyayamana bloc, you have the what had been internal opposition bloc, and you have the RPF. So there is somewhat meticulous apportioning of places based on this tripartite arrangement.
And can you just read the amount of portfolios each party gets for us?
The MRND gets 5 portfolios. The RPF gets 5 portfolios. The MDR gets 4, including the post of prime minister. This, I think, is a reflection of the fact that it is really the major contender for power inside the country. So you have a president who is the MRND, and you have a prime minister who is the MDR. The PSD got 3 portfolios, the PL got 3 portfolios, and the PDC got 1.
Okay. Lastly, I would like for you to go to Article 66, or 62, which is the next page, and page 54 on the French version. Do you see it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now here they appear to be discussing a transitional national assembly. Can you tell us about this?
The same kind of division of power which was reflected in the ministerial positions is carried through in a transitional assembly, which was to be the legislative body in the transitional period. And once again, there is this carefully spelled out division of power among the contenders, where the MRND has 11 seats, the RPF 11 seats, the MDR 11 seats, the PSD 11 seats, the PL 11 seats, and the PDC 4 seats.
Okay. Do you have any knowledge or about what the timetable for the implementation of this transitional government was at this time? Was there one set, if you know?
The timetable, which was the relevant one, was actually established at the time of the final signature in August. Right. Of August of 93, and that was a very abbreviated timetable of 37 days.
Okay, in fact, we'll wait and we'll talk about that in further details. Thank you. Now I would like to move to September of 1992. You know, what we have here is apparently we have these ceasefires that have been signed and this August agreement. But inside the country, what was happening as far as the ethnic, I guess, relations or those issues, if you know?
The signature of the first part of the Arusha Accords appeared to cause serious worry to the political circles around President Habyarimana, and also to certain important military leaders. There had been a document prepared earlier in the year as part of a commission report, a commission which had been put into operation in December of 91 by the military to examine possible ways to win the war. This commission had recommended a number of measures, including the removal or the recommended retirement of several high-ranking military officers who had been close to Habsyarimana. In addition, it had produced a section of the document in which it analyzed and defined, quote, the enemy, unquote. This document, according to a diplomatic source who was acquainted with the situation, was actually produced in the spring, probably in March, April, maybe May, of 92. But it actually came to our attention as a result of being circulated to all commanders of all units on September 21st, 1992.
Let's stop here for a second. At this time, with the chamber's permission, I would like for you to look at Exhibit 25 and 25A. Can you please tell us what this is, these are?
This is Exhibit 25 is the English translation of 25A. 25A is the original document, which was written in French. 25A is a letter dated September 21st, 1992, from Colonel De Gracias Nsabimana, who was Chief of Staff of the Rwandan Army. It is directed to List A, commanders of all the operational sectors, and it is marked secret. The letter was a letter of transmittal of the attached document, which is entitled Definition and Identification of the Enemy, ENI in the French, standing for enemy.
Which document would you like to work from, the original or the translated English version?
I think it's preferable to work from the original if possible.
Okay. Could you briefly, I guess, point out to us some of the passages in this document that, I guess, give us the essence of this document and basically describe who the enemy is?
First of all, I'd like to call your attention to the letter of transmittal itself, in which Colonel Nsabimana directs his officers to diffuse the document broadly. In other words, although the letter of transmittal is secret, the contents of the attached document are to be widely distributed. And the he also warns them that he also indicates that this document should, and I'm here reading from the final sentence of the next to last paragraph.
This should lead our men to remain more vigilant and to not count only on political negotiations.
Clearly, the document, the definition of the enemy, which had existed in a drawer someplace for a number of months, has been brought out and circulated because of the peace agreement. I read this as a clear warning to the military: do not let down your guard. This is not finished yet. This war is not over. And it is important not to rely solely upon negotiations.
Doctor, let's stop here for a minute before we go further. How do we know that this is authentic, or we should give it some sort of credit or reliability?
This document was given to the International Commission. And at the time I was in Rwanda with that commission in January of 93, I discussed its contents with a number of high-ranking government officials in Rwanda who confirmed for me its authenticity. It had been already fairly widely circulated. It was widely discussed in diplomatic circles, and I have never heard its authenticity questioned.
of the enemy.
The very beginning, this is on the second page, the definition of the enemy. The enemy is divided into two categories, the principal enemy and the partisans of the enemy. The principal enemy is the Tutsi inside the country or outside the country, who is extremist and nostalgic for power, and who has never recognized and who will not recognize the realities of the social revolution of 1959, and who wants to conquer power in Rwanda by all means, including by arms. And then the second part of the definition, the partisan of the enemy is any person who supports or who gives any assistance to the principal enemy. The document then proceeds to list the possible forms of action by the enemy or his partisan, including armed attack, buying arms, collecting money, material support to the enemy under whatever form, doing propaganda favorable to the enemy. And here, there's a little bit of a linguistic question, because in English, to do propaganda for the enemy is, I believe, a more targeted kind of activity than would be described by the French phrase. If I am not mistaken, the French faire de la propagande favorable à l'ennemi would be a less strong phrase. It would be perhaps talk favorably about the enemy, as opposed to the stronger English, to do propaganda for the enemy. To recruit for the enemy, to intoxicate public opinion, to mislead public opinion by rumor and false information, to spy for the enemy, divulge military secrets to the enemy, serve as a liaison agent for the enemy, to organize terrorism or sabotage in support of the enemy, to organize or stimulate revolts, strikes, and disorders of all kinds, to support the enemy, to refuse to combat the enemy, and to refuse to satisfy war requisitions. In the next category, enemy milieu, the social groups from which the enemy is recruited. Unfortunately, this copy is not very clear, but the first line under this is Tutsi refugees. The next line is the NRA, meaning the Army of Uganda. And then underneath that comes Tutsi of the interior, Tutsi inside the country. And next after that, Hutu who are dissatisfied with the government in place. People without work, the unemployed inside and outside the country. Foreigners married to Tutsi women. And here a very general category, the Nilo-Hamitic people of the region. This returns to the idea which we discussed very briefly the other day of the notion that the Tutsi were from the northeastern part of Africa, Nilo-Hamitic being an outdated term for speakers of for people who came from that part of Africa. Criminals in flight. Those are all the categories of people among whom the enemy and partisans of the enemy are recruited. There is then an identification of the places where the enemy is active, including Uganda, Zaire, Belgium, Switzerland, Germany, the United States, Burundi, and so on. Following that is a paragraph saying that some of these Tutsi, and here I stress the word is Tutsi, not members of the RPF or any other descriptor, but the usage here is of Tutsi as being equivalent to the enemy. Some of these Tutsi have even succeeded in infiltrating certain international organizations as officials, as functionaries, including the OAU, the BAD, UNESCO, the European Community, PNUD, the UNDP, and some associations of human rights.
Doctor, let me stop you here for a minute. What we'll do is, for the most part, we'll let this document speak for itself, but are there any other passages that you think our attention should be drawn to at this present time?
Yes. If you would turn to what is page 7, at the top of the page, there's a page 7.
Can you give us a, I guess if there's a heading of some sort so that...
Yeah, sorry. This is under 2, methods and methods and means of the enemy. And near the bottom of the page, under paragraph 1, subparagraph A, the very final paragraph, in fact, of the page. In its campaign of propaganda, of public awareness, the enemy has been able to recruit some former Hutu authorities and other Hutu discontented with the government in order to disguise the Tutsi label of its hegemonic policies or politics, and so to win Hutu to its cause. And here again, you see reappearing the same concern which appeared in the letter of the prefects in 91, in the press release of the military in December of 91, this fear that the current holders of political power are going to lose to an eventual union of the RPF and members of groups opposed to them. At the bottom of page 8, I would call your attention to a list of names of persons who are described as participants in the activities of the enemy, particularly to the name of Everest Sisi and the name of Antoine Sebera. They come about in the middle of that list of names.
Actually, why should our attention be drawn to those names?
Okay. The next day after this letter went out to the military, the CDR issued a press release in which it also listed a series of names of people described as enemies of the country, traitors to the country, and those two names appear also on that same list. So you have in succession on 2 days the military authority publicizing among the troops the names of certain people as enemies, and the very next day the CDR itself putting forth the same message to the general population in a press release. I would also draw your attention on page 9 to a paragraph which is at the fourth the fourth indicator, the fourth dash, the fourth dash here. The authors of the document are speaking of the tactics of the enemy. And one tactic which is described here is
drawing national opinion away from ethnic problems to socioeconomic problems between the rich and the poor.
So these military authorities are saying one strategy of our opponents is to try to turn public opinion away from the ethnic problem by instead stressing the problem of differences between the rich and the poor. This goes to the fundamental issue of this conflict, which is the effort of a small group of people to hold on to power in the face of growing popular resistance against their increasing wealth and corruption. This has been the basis of the growing dissent within the country. It has been a dissent focused on the narrow interests of Habyarimana and his circle. It has not been a dissent concerned with the ethnic issue. And these military authorities are saying, by focusing on the social economic issue, they distract people from the ethnic issue. And it is the ethnic issue that must be stressed. If I could recall for you my analysis of the 1973 violence against Tutsi, where I talked about attacking the Tutsi as a means to distract from conflicts among the Hutu, to recreate Hutu solidarity on the backs of the Tutsi. We see here a reference to that exact strategy. We must distract the Hutu from the social and economic issues, the growing poverty in this country, which is in fact a very serious concern. All of the foreign money that's coming in aid projects is becoming increasingly focused in one region and in the hands of one set of people. And we must distract the opposition from the growing social economic gap by instead focusing on the ethnic problem. I believe that those are the major passages to which I would like to draw attention at this time, although later we may have need to refer to this document again. It's a very important document.
May I just ask you a question? You just used the term the ethnic problem. Mm-hmm. I take it that you are thereby quoting those people who edited this paper.
Yes, I am.
I take it is correct, my understanding, that you personally, you don't see the fact that you have different so-called ethnic groups to be a problem.
No, thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. Sometimes I get carried away in using the language of the people whom I am speaking of. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify that it is not indeed my opinions, but rather those of the authors of the document to which I have been referring. I do not regard the presence of multiple ethnic groups as a problem.
Thank you.
Now, at this time, after the distribution of this document, I guess we're talking about September of 92, you go into October. What do we see happening in the country in relation to, I guess, the peace agreement which was signed and maybe some of the ethnic issues?
There is the CDR organized a major demonstration, well, not major so much in terms of numbers, but major in terms of its virulence against the peace accords, taking people out to the street to protest the peace agreement and simultaneously to thank the French for their support. At the end of October, there was a military mutiny of some seriousness that Habyarimana himself had to intervene to put down. The military had been, were dissatisfied with the peace accords, a certain number of them in any case, in part because they didn't want to accept defeat, but also because the army had grown enormously in numbers. At the start of the conflict, the army had numbered about 7,000, and by this time it numbers some 30,000. The peace accords, of course, would mean a major demobilization of the army. And those soldiers who had begun to enjoy the salary, and sometimes the salary wasn't so regular, but at least the opportunity to extract resources from ordinary civilians on the basis of their military status, were not pleased at the prospect of being demobilized and sent back to hoe the beans. The Prime Minister had attempted to address this by proposing a form of sort of national development work into which demobilized soldiers could be put, including such things as draining the marshes and agricultural projects. This created a very angry reaction among the soldiers, I think because they felt they had left that work behind. And this was no doubt one of the reasons for this mutiny at the end of October.
Okay. Did the president ever address this and talk about, I guess, the problems he was having and maybe the ceasefire agreement itself?
In mid-November, Habyarimana gave a speech to a military audience in which he referred to the peace accord as un chiffon de papier, a scrap of paper, a nothing, thereby suggesting to the military and to the public in general that the peace accord, although it had been signed, would not necessarily be the last word. I recall discussing this speech with members of the diplomatic community who were shocked and outraged that this peace agreement, which so many had worked so carefully to craft, was dismissed casually by Habyarimana in that speech.
Microphone to the judge. We will adjourn for 15 minutes. Session is adjourned.
The session is called to order. Could you please have the witness brought in, Mr. Bailiff? I wanted to say that we are going to have to adjourn our sessions this morning so that we come back to the sessions this afternoon because the accused is not well and would wish that we enable him to withdraw so that he can come back fresher at 2:30. I think this might suit the witness, whom we have also tired somewhat. That's one. Now, secondly, I want to ask the prosecutor, does he intend to conclude the examination of the witness this afternoon? If that is the case, we shall not sit tomorrow and we will only resume on Tuesday. If it's not the case, we shall sit tomorrow exceptionally from 9 until 11 o'clock.
Your Honor, it is a little difficult for me to say. However, what I can say is I will make best efforts to finish this afternoon. It will be close, though.
Please be assured, Mr. Prosecutor, that we're not exerting pressure on you so that you finish your examination, because we have to come back tomorrow if you haven't finished. So I think we should understand one another. Take your time. We're here for that. If you haven't, we will not have finished this afternoon. I'm saying that in that case, we shall continue tomorrow from 9 o'clock until 11. But if you will have finished this afternoon, I'm also saying that we'll have to come back only on Tuesday. I think that's clear. So the session is adjourned until 2:30 this afternoon.